Joining me in the studio now is Dr. Erwin Altman, who is a professor and chairman of the University of Utah's Department of Psychology. He's in Philadelphia for the Interior Design Educators Council, which is called IDEC, where he is being honored for his research into how people respond to and use the environment. He's also a founding member of the Environmental Design Research Association and has written a book called Environment and Social Behavior. I think of environmental design as being a relatively new word and a relatively new field, although aspects of it were covered by architecture and by interior design, but environmental design somehow means something different to me. Is it indeed a new field?
Well, I think it is a new field. It's coming to not only involve people in the professions of architecture and planning and interior design, but for the first time within the last 10 years, we see the entry of social and behavioral scientists, psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, geographers, people like that, who are beginning to join with traditional environmental designers to begin thinking about the environment in other than just physical terms. Mm-hmm. So it is a new field in that sense.
In other words, how the environment affects the way you feel within it and
yes,
how you structure your environment?
Both the way in which the environment affects people. That's the way we usually think about it. But one of the influences that the social scientists are bringing in is the idea that people also affect the environment. And people use the environment in their dealings with one another. So it's really a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very exciting part of this field.
Okay, let's get into some of the specifics that I know you've been studying. You have concentrated on personal space. Now, is that in terms of how much space an individual needs, say, for instance, within a home or within an office?
Well, no. Personal space refers really to the very simplest part of the way in which we use the environment. It refers primarily to distances between people. And there's an anthropologist by the name of Edward Hall who has written a very interesting book that your listeners might want to read called The Hidden Dimension. And Hall talks about four personal space zones or distances that we maintain from one another. For example, the very intimate zone is one that's less than a foot and a half or 2 feet. And you typically will not see people this close to one another. And if you want to try this, get that close to your neighbor or somebody you don't know very well, and the first thing that you'll begin to feel is a real sense of discomfort. And the person that you get that close to will become very uncomfortable. So this is a personal space zone that's a very intimate one and that people only use with folks that they know very well or in very intimate situations. There's another zone, the next one, which is kind of a transition zone called the personal zone, which is between a foot and a half and 4 feet. Hall describes this as kind of a zone where lovemaking in the movies begin. People either get very close or they pull away from one another. And then he talks about some other zones that are more typical. For example, you and I in this interview are sitting in the next zone, which he calls a social zone, which is between 4 and 12 feet. We're sitting across a table. The table is 30 inches wide, which is a standard table. And in sitting in the chairs, we tend to keep that kind of a socially acceptable distance. So just the simple idea of distance between people is a way in which we use the environment.
Now, what kind of practical applications does that have in, for instance, designing a working space?
Well, I think it does have practical applications because if you design workspaces that violate some of our cultural ideas about how far apart people should be, you're going to create some difficulty. Or if we had been sitting here at a table that was 4 feet wide, then we would have had a different kind of contact with one another than if we're sitting at this standard distance. So either getting people in positions where they're too far from one another or too close to one another can have very practical implications. Communication
mm-hmm.
would be affected.
There's a lot of offices where I think they're referred to as open space offices, maybe,
mm-hmm.
where there's maybe
mm-hmm.
like 30 desks in a row. You see this kind of situation in a lot of banks.
That's right.
And secretarial pools.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that kind of space arrangement where it's just in rows, and if you're in the back, you're seeing the heads of maybe 10 people
well,
in front of you?
Well, there's a whole new movement in environmental design called open office landscaping, where they're doing away with offices in the traditional sense of four walls
mm-hmm.
and a door. Now, they're not moving toward this open bay notion of people just lined up in rows. What they're trying to do is use flexible partitions of different sizes and configurations so that people can have varying amounts of privacy and varying amounts of control over who they deal with. The idea is to avoid either the extreme of total separation or the extreme of no separation between people to build flexible kinds of environments. So this is a whole new field, relatively little is known about how to do this effectively, and we are just beginning to evaluate different methods for office landscaping.
When people are too close in either a working or a living environment, what kind of effect do you think it has on them psychologically?
Well, we don't have any specifically hard data on that kind of a question, but the literature generally shows that when people get too close to one another, inappropriately, this becomes rather anxiety-provoking. It becomes rather difficult, and people don't like it. On the other hand, I think the opposite is true also, and that is that if people don't have the right degree or amount of closeness with one another, then you run into difficulties also. So it's kind of it's more of an optimization sort of thing, with too much or too little not being really effective. And what you have to do in a situation is try and figure out what the appropriate and average demands of the situation are.
Well, now that an environmental design is a discipline unto itself, a cross-discipline perhaps, are architects who are designing new houses more and more taking into consideration the amount of space needed by a family and how it should be divided?
I think they've always been doing this in a way. They always have been working with clients and trying to find out what it is that clients need. I think what's different now is that they're beginning to realize that they may need more systematic methods for doing this. They need to work on a better scientific base rather than on a strictly intuitive artistic base. So again, it's not that architects haven't been doing this. They've been doing it and doing it very well in general. But I think many of them feel that the time has come to try and do it a little more systematically, and they feel that the social sciences, with our methods and approaches and theoretical positions, may be able to do this. Now, that doesn't always work out either.
As you said, you can tell something about people by the way they organize their environmental space, and I know that you've looked at families and how they organize space. What are some of the things that you found in that regard?
Well, we did a pretty large-scale survey a few years ago where we asked people very simple questions. We asked them, where do they have dinner? Where do people in the family sit? Do they leave their bedroom doors open or closed? Do they eat in the dining room or in the kitchen? And a lot of silly questions like that. And what we came up with on the basis of simple questionnaires were two kinds of family styles. We found that there's one kind of family that I would characterize as an open family, in the sense that these families report that people all keep their bedroom doors open, for example, when they're in the room, for a variety of things, sleeping, studying, entertaining, you know, whatever. And it turns out that those families are also the families that eat in the kitchen.
The families that keep their bedroom doors
open,
right.
Eat so
in the kitchen.
Bedroom door openers are kitchen eaters. And furthermore, those kinds of families use the kitchens for a variety of things. They just don't have meals there. They'll just sit around and talk with one another and entertain people.
Do they necessarily have dining rooms? I mean, I've often lived in houses where there was no dining room.
Well, the interesting thing is about these different kinds of families is that they're from the same socioeconomic background. They're the same kind of people, same education, same family size, but they have different styles for using their space. Furthermore, the people who we'll call them bedroom door openers and kitchen eaters are also people who tend to use the kitchen for many things. They tend to have particular kinds of seating patterns in the kitchen. For example, in most of the families we deal with, the father sits at the end of the table. You know, that's sort of the American way, the father at the head of the table and so on. But in these families, the mother sits at the other end of the table with the kids sort of in between. Whereas the families that keep their bedroom doors closed, who eat in the dining room, tend to have the mother sitting more at the father's corner. See, these tend
you mean
to be
closer to the father?
Yeah, catty corner with the father, with the father at the end and the mother either at the father's immediate left or right. So we see you see the beginning of different styles of use of home environments, probably reflecting the way in which families function with one another. Give you another interesting kind of thing that goes along with these other things, and that is that people who leave their bedroom doors open, who eat in the kitchens, where the mothers sit at the other end of the table, are also families in which the kids don't have strict job assignments. The kids kind of rotate in their jobs, you know, taking out the trash and cutting the grass and so on. Whereas in the other families, there's a much more strict assignment of jobs.
The people who close their doors is a more
yes.
strict
Yeah, they tend to have a more formal way of doing business as a family. We also find that the open families, the open door families and so on, report spending more time together in free activities, recreational activities than the others. They tend to be They tend to knock on closed doors more, whereas the other family just sort of barrels through the doors even if they're closed. So the point is that you can learn a great deal about how a family lives and what its social structure is by just asking simple questions about the way in which they use their environment. So the environment reflects them as a social group in a very vivid way.
Okay, so from what you're saying, I would kind of, you know, jump to the conclusion that the open door kitchen eaters are more closely knit, respect each other's privacy more because they can leave their door open.
You're implying, well, I think you can make some inferences about their way of functioning, but I don't think it's appropriate to think that one is better than the other.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people want to be the open door family. You know, they want to say everybody, we all deal with one another. So I don't think that's necessarily true. I think either system can be a very viable one, a very healthy one. And at this point, we really shouldn't say that one is a better way of organizing a family environment than the other.
I've come across families where it's kind of a taboo thing to close the door because the family wants to maintain the sense of openness. Is that considered at all in the survey? I mean, those families that maintain open door policy out of policy and not out of a real feeling for that?
Well, we don't really know. It's hard to say how it happens and so on. But one of the things that open-door families, when you ask them what's the worst thing about their whole home environment, they say the worst thing is they don't have enough privacy. See, so it's hard to say that one is a better way of functioning than another. I just think they are.
Is that at all a function of how large the house is?
Well, I don't think so in this sample because we didn't see any differences in family size,
mm-hmm.
in composition of the family, and how much space they had. These tended to be mostly average American families. These were essentially lower middle class families who were in their own home. And
So where do you go from there?
Well, I think one of the places you go from there is, well, the information is interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, it is. It's okay. Very interesting.
I think that environmental designers who are in the business of building homes might very well use this kind of information to find out what family styles are and maybe perhaps to design environments differently for different kinds of families.
Okay. Territorial behavior. Does that fall under what we were talking about?
Well, I think it's related. The way in which people use the term territorial behavior refers to the ownership and possession of areas and objects in the environment. It's easy to think about territorial behavior in terms of animals. We know that animals establish territories, places which they defend, which they mark, and so on. And I think there's enough literature to suggest that humans do this also. The notions of our home being our castle, of private rooms, of signs, fences, nameplates, all reflect the fact that we identify places with ourselves, that we have some sense of ownership and control over them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think humans do exhibit territorial behavior, and violations of territorial behavior often lead to conflict of one kind or another.
That kind of ties in with what you were talking about, open and closed doors. If you had kind of barged in a closed-door family to someone who closed their door for a reason, that would
that's right. I think, and it's interesting to watch as children grow up how they develop a sense of territorial behavior about their place, and this is often a crisis in families.
Now, what we're talking about as territorial behavior strikes me as something that maybe Freud would have called anal behavior, someone who orders things and it has to kind of be close to them, be strictly theirs. Do you know what I'm saying?
I never made that connection before, but that's an interesting one. Maybe there is a link between those, but the notion of territorial behavior refers more to places, to ownership, and to control over those places.
You've looked at the structure and design of low-cost housing. Would you say that in general low-cost housing takes into consideration these factors less than other forms of housing, that it's just kind of built efficiently and cheaply, and that's that?
Well, I haven't looked at that myself in my own research, but there are several people who have done it. One of the most well-known ones is Oscar Neumann, who looked at low-cost housing in a number of cities, and he collected data that tried to show a relationship between the degree to which a low-cost housing development or neighborhood permitted territorial control and the incidence of crime. And what he claims to have found is that when an environment does not permit territorial control over the place, you tend to get a higher incidence of crime. For example, many low-cost housing developments in large cities are high-rise places. All the buildings look alike. There are no distinctive entrances. There are no distinctive paths that people have to follow, and so on. And he claims that those kinds of environments do not permit territorial surveillance. That is, the occupants cannot really watch who's coming into buildings and into areas. They can't really control them. The places are completely public.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels that this is one of the main factors associated with crime. As contrasted with similar low-cost housing developments, where there are hedges built, where the entrances are angled, like right-angle entrances, where there are paths clearly marking the way into the place, and so on. And Newman argues, and it makes a lot of sense, there are some people who question his data, but I think the general theory makes sense, that if a place cannot be under the control of the occupant, either from the point of view of the occupant or from the point of view of somebody coming into the place, that everyone then has free access. So the easier it is to get into a place, put this in other terms, the easier it is to cross boundaries, almost like a door is a boundary. The easier it is to cross boundaries and the less marked the boundaries are, the greater the probability that you're going to have intrusions and invasions and violations of territories.
Is that coming from people within that territory who as a reaction to having their space violated in turn?
Well, if it's their space, the chances are their space is being violated by outsiders, and that's what he claims crime is all about, that outsiders don't see the boundaries. The boundaries aren't strong, and therefore they get access much more easily, and then the people who live there have very little control about who comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get conflict. It's the whole notion almost of national boundaries. We tend to try to establish national boundaries in a very firm way. We have signs, we have border guards, we have fences, and so on, to prevent conflict between nations. Sometimes we have buffer zones, like in Korea. The way in which that conflict was solved was to create a buffer zone which belonged to both and which belonged to neither. Well, you can sort of bring that notion right down to the level of individual housing, and you may even be able to bring it into families. I suspect a lot of family conflict happens among parents and growing children when parents ignore the fact that their children are beginning to want to develop strong boundaries. And the children are laying down the boundaries, and the parents aren't seeing them, or they're not responding to them.
You're very aware of all this, and I'm wondering how you design your own space. I mean, do you design like your own living and working space, kind of drawing on the research that you've done?
Well, my wife sort of controls the living space, but I try to bring these notions into my own workspace. For example, I have an office that's large enough, and I have enough furniture that I have created different kinds of space there. For example, I have a desk, and I have a chair on the other side of the desk, facing the desk. But in the same office, I also have a series of four chairs around a coffee table. So depending upon the kind of relationship that I want to establish with the person that comes into my office, I have different space available.
Now, if I walked into your office and you sat me down on the chair next to the desk, being kind of mildly aware of this type of behavior, would I maybe feel insulted, you know, I'm talking at the desk and not at the coffee table.
Well, you might, but what that in effect would be doing would be telling you that we have a certain kind of role relationship, that I want our relationship to be a little formal.
Mm-hmm.
And when I know people are coming to ask me for money, for example, then I'll sit them on the other side of the desk rather than sit around the coffee table with them. But when I want to create a more informal, more personal, more intimate setting, then I will ask people to sit in certain places, and then I can even vary the location of the seat.
Okay, my question, I guess, is if this is being done with two people who kind of know the rules of the game, is the game less effective?
Well, in a sense, no, it's more effective because they know, because it's my turf, my territory, and I control what happens there, then they know what kind of a relationship I'm interested in having. Now, they may not like that, but at least it's clear. There's less ambiguity about what it is we're going to be doing and the circumstances under which we're doing it. So in a sense, they may be unhappy, but it's also clearer about what's going on. So it depends on how you want to look at it.
Right. Okay, well, I've been speaking with Dr. Erwin Altman, and he is in Philadelphia this week for the Interior Design Educators Council annual convention, and he's being honored there for his research into how people respond to and use the environment. He's also, by the way, a founding member of the Environmental Design Research Association and has written a book called Environment and Social Behavior. Dr. Altman, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to travel to WUHY this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been very enjoyable.
And that's going to conclude Fresh Air for this afternoon. I do hope you have a good weekend. My name's Terry Gross, and thank you for listening.